The headlines: Iran's president tells a regional security conference that state sponsors of terrorism should not be allowed to set the rules of the war on terror. Russia rains down missiles on dozens of Ukrainian cities while Ukraine's air force keeps hitting Russian targets. And also in our headlines, UK energy regulator is gearing up to urge British people to use less energy out of the cold winter. Hello and welcome, everybody. The Iranian president says those states that loot the riches of independent nations in the name of war, in the name of war on terror, can never be trustworthy partners.
We should note that countries which themselves breed terrorists should not define rules and regulations of fighting terrorism. Bullies which have taken the global financial system hostage and keep plundering the wealth of nations cannot be reliable partners in shaping the new order.
Raisi made the comments hours ago at the sixth summit of the Conference on Interaction and Confidence-Building Measures in Asia, known as CICA. He added that hegemonic powers are seeking to destabilize independent countries and hamper their progress and convergence. Iran's president urged countries in the region to work together closely to foil the superpowers' plots and ensure security and stability in Asia. Elsewhere in his remarks, President Raisi touched upon attempts by hegemonic powers to put pressure on Iran using sanctions and threats in order to secure their own interests.
International bullies led by the U.S. have always wanted to go against the will of the Iranian nation and challenge its rights and interests. Throughout all these years, Iranian people have faced different threats such as war, sanctions, terrorism, coup attempts, and breach of promises.
President Raisi said Iranians have invalidated Washington's military option against Iran. He said the White House itself has admitted that its so-called maximum pressure policy against Tehran has ended up in an embarrassing failure. According to Raisi, now that the United States' militarism and sanctions policy have failed, it has opted to destabilize Iran. But he said the Iranian nation has scared the U.S. and its allies by relying on its own power and seeking to both make progress and ensure its security. And after three failed attempts this year, Iraqi lawmakers will be meeting again today to elect a new president. Parliament Speaker Mohammad al-Halbousi has said that the upcoming session would have a single item on its agenda, and it will be the election of the president of the republic. He elected the new president will invite the nominee of the largest bloc to form a government. The United Nations has warned that the current political stalemate will only lead to further instability in the country. Iraq has been without a head of state since parliamentary elections in October of last year. During the elections, Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr's political party won the most number of seats, but Sadr asked all his MPs to resign after he failed to form a government. He soon started asking for the dissolution of the parliament and early elections. That prompted a wave of protests and even deadly clashes in the country. Saudi Arabia says criticisms of the kingdom over an OPEC Plus decision last week to cut its oil production are not based on facts. The Saudi Foreign Ministry is arguing that the oil cut was based on a purely economic context. It says the unanimous decision took into account the balance of supply and demand and was meant to curb market volatility. The statement comes in response to U.S. President Joe Biden's remarks, warning of consequences and saying Washington is reevaluating its relationship with Riyadh. OPEC Plus has agreed to slash output by 2 million barrels per day. The decision comes at a time when Europe and the U.S. are already looking at fuel shortages and price hikes caused by the Ukraine war. U.S. officials have accused Saudi Arabia of siding with Russia. A top Democrat senator has even proposed the suspension of all arms sales to the Saudi government.
OPEC Plus countries, an alliance between the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries and other major oil producers, are in the limelight as the Saudi-led organization agreed to cut output by an amount equal to about 2% of global supply from November. Their decision would curb production in a tight market. It is the biggest reduction by OPEC Plus since 2020, when it cut production by more than 9 million barrels per day in response to the pandemic. The move is designed to boost the cost of oil, which has fallen below $90 per barrel from a peak of $122 in June. Prices rose after the announcement. The U.S. had asked OPEC Plus not to go ahead with the cuts, partly because lower prices mean less revenue for Russia to be used in the Ukraine war. The White House called the decision short-sighted. In July, U.S. President Joe Biden visited Saudi Arabia to ask Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to increase oil production. However, he refused. And now tensions are escalating between Washington and Riyadh. U.S. President Joe Biden says there will be consequences for Saudi Arabia's behavior. Biden did not disclose options he was considering and the timeline of action. Bob Mendez called on the White House to limit arms sales and military cooperation with Saudi Arabia. Three legislators have already introduced a bill to withdraw troops and missile systems from Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates. But Riyadh has defended its decision for oil production cuts, saying OPEC has a pivotal role in achieving balance and stability in global markets. Today, OPEC nations produce around 30% of the world's crude oil. Saudi Arabia is the biggest single oil producer within OPEC, producing more than 10 million barrels a day. While claims that the Saudis and Emiratis and the rest of OPEC Plus are biased toward Russia seem overstated, it is clear that they are not shunning them. These are one of several economies looking to maintain their ties with both Russia and the US and are willing to operate in the gray areas, engaged in trade and financial flows which don't directly violate US sanctions but are risky and could be subject to future restrictions.
Well, the U.S. says it's reevaluating the relationship with Saudi Arabia after the OPEC Plus decision last week to cut 2 million barrels a day of oil production. The decision could push up gasoline prices in the U.S. ahead of the midterm elections next month. It also hinders U.S. efforts to restart, or rather restrict, Russia's oil revenue over the war in Ukraine. Riyadh says oil production curbs are purely economic, but critics in Washington accuse the kingdom of empowering Moscow.
Saudi Foreign Minister Faisal bin Farhan Al Saud has described the decision by OPEC Plus as a purely economic measure taken with the unanimous agreement of the group's members. Bin Farhan also lauded ties between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia as strategic. Also, some of Saudi Arabia's supporters have argued that the security relationship between Washington and Riyadh is mutually beneficial, not a favor from the U.S. In August, the United States approved massive arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, worth more than $5 billion, amid criticism of their ongoing military aggression in Yemen, which has inflicted heavy civilian casualties. Saudi Arabia is the largest customer of U.S.-made military equipment. Now, with this latest production cut, the critics of Biden's decision to appease Saudi Arabia and to gloss over the murder of the Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi are calling for a complete overhaul of the U.S.-Saudi relationship.
North Korea says it has test-fired two long-range strategic cruise missiles amid heightened tensions on the Korean Peninsula. North Korea's state media said the projectiles flew some 2,000 kilometers and hit their targets without specifying what the targets were. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un personally oversaw the test, hailing it as another clear warning to Pyongyang's enemies. Kim added that the North has to expand its nuclear strategic armed forces to deter any crucial military crisis at any time. Pyongyang has carried out nearly 10 missile tests in the past 2 weeks, including the one that flew over Japan. The North says its tests are necessary countermeasures to joint military drills by the South, the United States, and Japan. Pyongyang considers such war games as a rehearsal for invasion. From Seoul, our correspondent Frank Smith sheds more light on the latest missile test by North Korea. Let's take a listen.
Well, what's most concerning about this launch by North Korea of two cruise missiles isn't really the distance, 2,000 kilometers. Their ICBM the other day flew much further, more than 4,500 kilometers, but it's the pattern These cruise missiles could fly in an evasive pattern, and coupled with North Korea's hypersonic missiles and submarine-launched ballistic missiles, indicates North Korea now has a credible tactical nuclear delivery force, which means it can hit targets here in South Korea, in Japan, and across the region, likely with nuclear weapons. Also concerning here is South Korea's response. South Korea launched a few missiles in response to North Korea's recent testing, and one of those missiles landed back on the base from which it was launched, with the warhead separating and landing some 700 meters from a civilian area. Another South Korean missile, they completely lost track of it. So that introduces, again, an element of risk to this sort of cycle of tension here, and also to this ongoing arms race we see between North Korea, South Korea, and the United States.
Moving on, the war in Ukraine is escalating to new proportions, with Russia firing missiles to more than 40 towns and cities. Ukrainian officials say the latest round of shelling has targeted the port city of Mykolaiv, and that a settlement in the region of the capital, Kiev, has been hit by explosive drones. Meanwhile, Ukraine's Air Force has also carried out 32 strikes on 25 Russian positions in the past 24 hours. The recent clashes come amid simmering tensions between Russia and the West over Ukraine. On Wednesday, a UN General Assembly resolution called Moscow's annexation of Ukrainian territory illegal. Additionally, Ukraine's Western allies have committed to more military aid. Russia, on the other hand, has repeated its objection to the West's growing involvement in the war. A senior Russian official has even warned that the admission of Ukraine to NATO could trigger World War III. British families bracing for a tough winter as officials are working on plans to convince citizens to save energy amid steep shortages. Chief executive of Britain's energy regulator, Jonathan Brearley, will be asking consumers today to start cutting down on consumption where possible. Ofgem is launching a campaign to help households reduce their electricity and gas usage, but just less than a week ago, Climate Minister Graham Stewart gave assurances that the country will not ask people to use less energy. UK's National Grid, which manages Britain's power and gas systems, has already warned of rolling three-hour blackouts. Britain has been dealing with soaring gas prices and a high inflation. It accuses Russia of using energy as a weapon in retaliation for Western sanctions and their support for Ukraine. Saeed Pourouzah is joining us now from the British capital, London, with all the latest on plans for Brits to be saving energy amid the upcoming cold winter. Saeed, what do you have to share with us?
This, Barry, comes exactly a week since conversations were mooted by the business department and energy companies to introduce these measures, to call on people to turn down their thermostats, use their dishwashers and washing machines other than peak times in order to bring down energy use at a time of heightened prices and shortages. But they didn't come out with an announcement at the time, the reason being that the Prime Minister Liz Truss, both during her leadership contest and after, has been saying that there wouldn't be any shortages. She was asked specifically if she would rule out any power shortages, and she said she did. But now this reeks of another U-turn by her and her government, coming on the back of an earlier U-turn on the abolition of the 40p tax cut, and other U-turns that seem to be on the cards as we go on. It's not going to bode well for her. It's not going to go down well at all. But why now? Why we're here? There is a shortage of energy in continental Europe, and of course, heightened prices globally as a result of the ongoing Western-backed war in Ukraine. We saw earlier the sabotage attacks on the two pipelines, the two Nord Streams, taking gas from Russia to Europe. But then, of course, gas is still flowing into Europe from Russia, inexpensive gas that the European economies are very dependent on. One pipeline, surprisingly, through Ukraine to Slovakia, and another one through the Black Sea to Turkey and then Bulgaria. But that is not definitely enough to sustain European countries through the winter. The UK doesn't have a massive storage of gas. It has a little over 2.5 billion cubic meters. It uses 300 million cubic meters. You do the math and you will have probably a week's worth of gas for the UK. So to do that, it'll have to rely on importing gas from continental Europe. Now, the Europeans have been able to store enough gas probably to sustain them through this winter, but they're looking at extortionate prices in the year after. What that means for the UK is that they're going to probably say, we need energy domestically, and we can't export to the UK. So that is going to put the UK in a very difficult position. Although the United Kingdom only depends on Russian gas for only 4% of its energy needs, it is definitely going to be in a very tough position, considering, for example, it relies on renewable energy. But then the weather forecast for the cold months is that there is not going to be a lot of wind, and so that also is going to be a huge problem. So what we're looking at, as you said earlier, is planned power cuts in the coming months, especially in January. That seems to be the plan at the moment, where people will be alerted with text messages, emails, and phone calls telling them 24 hours beforehand that at a certain time they're not going to have power for a few hours. And of course, apparently there's going to be incentives for people to do so, for turning down their thermostats. Energy companies saying that they're going to give money back to the people if they follow their instructions.
Sure.
But households seem to be a priority. But what will happen in the event there is acute shortage, which is seems to me where we're headed, the large industrial companies will be first to have to follow those rules. Vardia.
All right, thanks a lot, Zaid Pudas, for joining us from the British capital, London. That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Birthday of the Prophet of Islam. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, the 17th of the Islamic month of Rabiul Awwal is believed by Shia Muslims as the birthday of the Prophet of Islam. Stay tuned for a special feature in this regard. 507 years after the birth of Prophet Jesus, peace upon him, on 17th of Rabiul Awwal, very queer events took place in the world. All idols fell down and broke into pieces. The palace of the Sasanid Emperor of Iran shook, and 14 turrets of the palace collapsed. The Save Lake, as the place of worship of fire worshippers, dried up. The Fars Fire Temple went out after 1,000 years of burning. A light shone from Hejaz and could be seen everywhere in the world. Devils were scared. The magic of magicians was null, and no king was able to speak. On this day, all creatures on earth and in the sky were happy, as the best creature, Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, was born. God endeared him among people and safeguarded him from every evil and harm. Then, as he reached the age of 40, God bestowed all sciences of both worlds to his heart and gave him the mission to guide the world people towards salvation. According to some of the Sunni sources, the Prophet introduced a few things as the principles of Islam. These things are monotheism, prophethood, daily ritual prayers, zakat, hajj, and fasting of Ramadan. Shia prominent scholar Sheikh Ya'qub Kulayni has narrated from Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, that Islam has been based on five things: daily ritual prayers, zakat, fasting, hajj, and velayat, God-given authority of the Ahlul Bayt, while velayat is superior to other four items. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, also says that testifying the oneness of God, belief in the Prophet's mission, spending of zakat, and accepting the velayat of the Prophet's Ahlul Bayt are the principles without which nobody's faith will be accepted. God says in the Quran that unity is the cause of superiority, while discord is the cause of decadence and failure. God says in Ayah 103 of Surah Al-Imran, "And hold fast to Allah's cord and do not be disunited." This ayah also considers brotherhood among Muslims as a divine favor. Hoisting the flag of monotheism has always been the common goal of all Muslims in the Islamic Ummah. All Muslims consider the Prophet as their best guide and leader. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, has thus been the axis of unity for Shias and Sunnis. The Prophet would advise Muslims to obey divine rulers, as it will guarantee unity and will consolidate the pillars of brotherhood among them. Then, the divine mercy will encompass them as the spring rain. Imam Ali, peace upon him, says that leadership in the Islamic Ummah is like the string which gathers all beads of the rosary. Thus, if this string is broken, all beads will be dispersed. The Imam reminds Muslims of the fate of Israelites, saying, "Look how the Israelites were. Once they had gathered together, thoughts and hearts were the same. Hands and swords were helping each other. Visions were deep and decisions were the same. Then, didn't they have great cities round the earth, and didn't they rule the world people? So, look at their end. When differences emerged among them, kindness was undermined. Words and hearts were different. They were divided into groups. They killed one another. They became dispersed and fought each other. Thus, God took off their attire of dignity and deprived them of his ample bounty. And what has remained from them is the source of admonition for those who will be admonished. All prophets and divine leaders have reminded us of God's precedence. God says to his prophet in Ayah 43 of Surah Fatir, "So you will never find any change in Allah's precedent, and you will not find any revision in Allah's precedent." The prophet of Islam says in this regard, "Do not bolt your differences. Those before you did this and were destroyed." He also says, "He who gets away one span from the Muslim community, God will take away the cord of Islam from his neck." Let us gather round the axis of unity, the messenger of mercy, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The U.S.-Saudi Arabia relationship has taken a beating since OPEC Plus decided to cut oil production by 2 million barrels. The U.S. has announced that it will reevaluate its relationship with the kingdom, such as arms sales. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether the degree this relationship, to what degree this relationship has been fractured, and whether U.S. politicians will follow through with their threats, including the U.S. President Joe Biden, whose party faces the midterms on rocky grounds due to inflation and high energy prices. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Hassan Ali joins us. He is a scientist, writer, and political analyst who joins us from New York. Also from New York, Daniel Lazar, journalist and author.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right, Hassan Ali, let me first start with you. Maybe we can get this out of the way right from the get-go. When you take a look at the reason behind this 2 million output cut, the the decision that was made by OPEC Plus, which many say Saudi Arabia leads, is that it was a necessity, given the world needs oil, especially Europe, in addition to the U.S., the counter, of course, argument against that. Was this a necessity, or was it a political decision made by Saudi Arabia leading OPEC Plus?
Well, in my opinion, it was a political decision. First of all, in the era of the United States unipolar hegemony, the ruling classes of other nations, they were incentivized to have a comparative relationship with the imperialist power, being the U.S. In today's multipolar world, there are other relationships to be made, Russia and China, for example, and many of these are not in the best interests of the imperialist power. Moreover, the OPEC nations are quickly realizing that the U.S. can't try to boss around Russia with a proxy war, even go as far as attacking vital infrastructure. So what's stopping the U.S. from turning on other OPEC nations? So for OPEC to cut their production down, they're telling the U.S., you can't boss us around with because the U.S. wanted to put a price cap on the oil. So to me, this is the Saudis saying, no, we're not going to put a price cap on. We're going to curtail production and try to raise their gas prices.
Well, when we take a look, Daniel Lazar, to the statements made by the U.S. and Western countries also, but more so from the U.S., there is one way of this to have been described, and that is that OPEC Plus is using energy as a weapon. Of course, the Saudi Arabian energy minister has responded to that by saying, show me how. Do you think Saudi Arabia is using energy as a weapon?
No, I actually don't. I disagree with the other guest. I think the gesture was primarily economic. Inflation is building around the world. Oil prices had been in decline for several months. They've fallen by about a third. They had fallen by about a third. And the Saudis wanted them back up, as simple as that. They need the revenue to keep up with their development plans, whatever you think of them, but they needed the revenue. And so they decided to cut production in order to bolster prices. I mean, when the Saudis cut production back in the mid 70s, that was at the height of U.S. domination of the global oil markets. But the Saudis didn't care. They knew they had the leverage, and they used it to drive prices back up. And I see this as primarily economic act rather than a political act.
Why, Hassan Ali, do you think this has been described, this oil cut, as a jab and rebuke to the Biden administration? Is that what Saudi Arabia is after with this decision, given the fact that they maybe hold the most influence in OPEC Plus?
Well, I see why people call it a jab or a rebuke. When Biden was running against Trump, he used Trump's relationship with MBS as political leverage and even sowed distrust and discontent with the Saudi government. So Biden then visited in July, and, you know, it was a well-publicized visit it was publicized as a way to mend relationships. But I don't think it even was in that scenario, because Biden said at that time, quote, this trip is about positioning America in this region for the future. We're not going to leave a vacuum for Russia or China to fill. Now, obviously, Saudi is playing both sides. So I agree with the notion that they have economic incentive, but I also believe that they have very strong political incentive. The unipolar hegemony is ending, and they have to create certain relationships with the rising powers.
Taking a look at the timing of this, Daniel Lazar, do you think that this has happened at this point, if there was a political incentive because of the midterms coming up? Do you think that was something that was in Saudi Arabia and OPEC Plus's calculations, maybe?
Well, I think it was certainly in the U.S. calculations. I mean, the reason that Biden went to went to Saudi Arabia in July is he wanted to talk down oil prices to strengthen his political hand in view of the upcoming midterm elections. The reason that Biden is so upset now is he thinks the Saudi increase, the OPEC plus action, hurts him in terms of the coming midterms, and he's undoubtedly correct. In fact, it makes him look very foolish, very weak, and I think he'll pay a price at the polls. But I think the Saudis, once again, main incentive was economic. It's not to say that they, they're aware that the world is a multipolar place these days. It's changing a great deal, and they're aware that they've got to position themselves vis-a-vis actors like Russia and China. And the world is a more complex, is getting to be a more complex place than ever was before. But then again, I just once again believe that the incentive is primarily economic. They need to bolster their revenue, and that's it. I mean, the world is being shaken by inflation. Inflation is remaking all economic relationships. It's very strong. It's very powerful, and the Saudis are trying to position themselves in terms of the. Of the growing inflationary wave and to benefit from it as best they can.
Well, since you mentioned Russia and China, I'm going to zoom in on the Russia factor here. Hassan Ali, this has been described also as an important boost to Russia. Not only that, it has been described as Saudi Arabia to have sided with Russia. Tell us whether, first of all, you agree, and why are these two angles being presented in this form and manner?
Well, first of all, the Saudis have every reason to play both sides. They don't necessarily need to play or pick one side or the other. However, even showing any sympathy towards the Russian side in this conflict is enough for the U.S. to, especially all the politicians in Washington, to be quite upset with them. Now, a lot of the left in the United States was questioning Saudi's motives for choosing Russia over the U.S., particularly because the U.S. has been funding arms to Saudi for the genocidal war against the Yemenis. However, I believe that Saudis can find their weapons elsewhere. They can find their weapons in Russia or China. And interestingly, now you're even seeing the progressives, for example, Bernie Sanders, suddenly now talk about and point to the Yemen war and the humanitarian crisis that's being caused. This is because Saudi is now shifting its military alliances away from the U.S., so now the U.S. has every reason to point to the war crimes related to it.
Well, since you are mentioning the politician there, Bernie Sanders, let's see what he has said. If Saudi Arabia, Daniel Lazar, this is for you, one of the worst violators of human rights in the world, wants to partner with Russia to jack up U.S. gas prices, it can get Putin to defend his monarchy. We must pull all U.S. troops out of Saudi Arabia, stop selling them weapons, and end its price-fixing oil, as he calls cartel. We don't call it that. What do you think about Bernie Sanders' statement?
I mean, first of all, Bernie Sanders has essentially supported a U.S. imperial policy all over the world for years. I mean, he is not a critic of U.S. military policy. I think he's absolutely outrageous. I mean, to be fair, he has opposed the Yemen war, but he has also beat the drum against Russia as much as any other U.S. politician in recent years. So all Sanders is doing now is just hopping on the bandwagon against Saudi Arabia because Saudi Arabia is not sufficiently anti-Russian. I mean, I think it's really ridiculous, and Sanders is making a fool of himself. But it's interesting that that in Washington, it's okay to kill tens of thousands of Yemenis and to destroy that society, but if you fail to get on board the American war agenda vis-a-vis Russia, then you're in big trouble.
Still kind of confused about the fact Hassan Ali, Saudi Arabia is set to side with Russia. This is what Robert Menendez has said. He's the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Aside from, I will not greenlight any cooperation with Riyadh until the kingdom reassesses its position with respect to the war in Ukraine. Then he says this has helped underwrite Putin's war through the OPEC Plus, and he calls cartel. So there's simply no room to play with when it's been being played both sides of the conflict. I mean, is that what Saudi Arabia, is that really what it is doing? Is it siding with Russia? Is it playing up the Ukraine conflict, both sides of the fence?
Well, to the imperialists, even fence-sitting is not taking a stand. I mean, of course, in my opinion, I can always argue a nation that just fence sits and is not taking a firm stance against this proxy war in Ukraine is doing something wrong. And of course, the imperialists can take the opposite position as well, right? No one likes fence sitters, but I totally understand Saudi's both economic and political incentives to play both sides here. But Menendez, he says it very directly. He says we will not greenlight any cooperation until the kingdom reassesses its position in respect to the war in Ukraine. That's the main impetus for the U.S. government right now.
Looking at what seems to be the repeated rhetoric coming from the U.S. through its politicians, Daniel Lazar, is the fact that they want there to be either pause or a complete stop to what they call the transfer of American warfare, including technology. This is something that has been said before. U.S. has threatened Saudi Arabia before with this, but it hasn't really happened, has it? I mean, even no. Biden wrote on that during his candidacy for presidency of the U.S. Why is it that they fail to follow through with this? Is it because they can't stop in terms of the money they're making, or what is the story here?
Well, there are a multitude of reasons. I mean, first of all, the U.S.-Saudi alliance goes back nearly 80 years. Saudi Arabia is America's oldest ally in the Middle East, before the U.S.-Israeli alliance. Saudi Arabia is an extremely important market for U.S. weapons sales. It's hugely important to the arms industry, and the U.S. just can't walk away from an outlet like that. But also, the U.S. wants to maintain control of the Persian Gulf. It wants to control the energy markets, and it can't do that without having some kind of working relationship with Saudi Arabia. Now, that relationship has come under strain, at many points over the past decades, most especially in the wake of 9/11, where clearly, elements of the Saudi royal family were implicated. But nonetheless, the U.S. just can't walk away from that relationship, and I doubt it will now.
Can Saudi Arabia walk away from that relationship, Hassan Ali?
I think we're reaching an era in which they could. I don't think we're necessarily near that moment just yet. I will say again that the OPEC nations are seeing very clearly that the U.S. will go to extreme measures to exert their control over oil and energy. I think Saudi is still in a time where they can continue to play both sides and maybe even swing back to a pro-U.S. side, right? They don't necessarily have to abandon the U.S. permanently at this moment. But I do agree that a time will come where Saudi and other nations have the power to step away from the relationship with the U.S. if it serves their own interest.
Well, some may say the time is now. I mean, we're looking at the shift that's happening, Daniel Lazar. We're looking at the fact that obviously the Biden administration, particularly Joe Biden, is not really favored in the kingdom. And at this point in time, even the Saudis have come out, believe it or not, making statements against the U.S., of which that was pretty interesting based on some of the reporting, which it says the current reactions consider them to be angry responses only because of the high prices of oil, which exceeded 9%, so they find themselves a way out of what is happening, is what some are saying. Now, is there a possibility that Saudi Arabia wants to limit its relationship with the U.S.? Is there a transformation taking place as we speak?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I think the Saudis want to control the relationship a bit more. Look at the Saudis were angry at the high-handed U.S. approach, in the wake of incidents like the Khashoggi murder, the Yemen war. The U.S. has talked down to the Saudis on many occasions. It's behaved in a very bossy, authoritarian manner, and that angered the Saudis. And the Saudis, therefore, when they had the leverage, they felt they were in a position to push back against the United States. They did so. So that's understandable. I mean, there is a certain political dimension to this conflict. And the Saudis want to rebalance the relationship, I would say. But I still am quite confident that the U.S., that the Saudis and the U.S. are closely joined. The Saudi military is highly dependent on U.S. weaponry, and I think the relationship will continue. I mean, I think it's a very bad thing. I think it's a disaster for the Middle East, but I'm quite confident the relationship will continue despite this latest, you know, this latest bump in the road.
So you have this oil cut that has been announced, Hassan Ali, but at the same time, you have Saudi Arabia who has said, we will maintain oil deliveries to Asia despite the OPEC plus cuts. At least seven customers, Saudi Arabia said, on the Asian continent will receive full contract volumes of crude oil in November ahead of the winter peak season. What do you think? Isn't that a way, a shift away from the U.S. then with that type of approach?
It's hard to say if it's a decisive shift because, again, I repeat that they have every incentive to play both sides here. I mean, even the Democratic establishments who are threatening to pull arms from them in response to that, I think it's a bluff. I think our other guest here is right that the U.S.-Saudi relationship is very strong for now. There's no reason to break it. The U.S. does not want these sales going out to the other Asian countries, especially because the cuts to the West and more sales to the East are resulting in deindustrialization in the West and an intensification of industrialization in the East. For the working people of the West, this is bad, and for the working people of Asia, this is good. And something bad for the working people will only result in political unrest. So this decision of Saudi to continue production, exporting energy out, allowing for production to increase, is only going to harm the political establishment of the West.
Mm-hmm. Can't help but think about what the former U.S. President Donald Trump said, Daniel Lazar, at one point, and that was back when Jamal Khashoggi was assassinated with the orders to have been given, according to the CIA anyways, by the Saudi Crown Prince. And basically, when the news broke out, he said, no, it can't be, there's not enough proof. And as days and somewhat weeks went by, he finally reached the point where he had to say why he's not condemning the Saudi Crown Prince. And he said, look, if we were to do anything against Saudi Arabia, then there will be eager sellers of arms. And it mentioned Russia right away and other arms manufacturers that are very eager to sell to Saudi Arabia. Is this what's driving this relationship?
Yeah, I think it is. I think that's a very important element. And I think that, you know, I think there isn't that much difference between Trump and Biden on this question. I mean, Biden, you know, values the Saudi as an outlet for U.S. arms. He also values them as an ally in the Persian Gulf area, and so therefore it's a very important alliance. It's a cornerstone of U.S. Middle East policy, and. And I think that essentially Trump, Biden, they both agree that this relationship is a very important one, and the U.S. is not going to respond in a precipitous manner to this latest price hike. There'll be some arguing back and forth. There'll be some, you know, a small amount of turbulence, but I really believe both sides will step in to calm things down eventually, to reestablish relations, to rebalance relations. And I expect the U.S.-Saudi alliance to continue despite this latest perturbation.
Well, the whole thing about supply and demand in this case and at this point in juncture, Hassan Ali, of what we're looking at is not something that is going to be short-lived. We're looking at a conflict that is probably going to keep dragging out. We're looking at 2023 based on the I don't know who you'd like to use as a reference, the World Bank, IMF, or are they all Washington-based, so it doesn't matter. It's the same source. But anyways, this demand side is still going to continue. If we're looking at the threat that Joe Biden has just placed, this just came in a couple hours back, where he says that I will enact anti-Saudi Arabia legislation once I get back from the western part of the U.S. I forget for what reasons he's there. And Saudi Arabia basically is on the track where they are rejecting all threats of economic sanctions or political pressure or false accusations, and they said that they will respond with greater action. So if they're going to respond with greater action, that's going to leave not only the U.S., but the world on the Western side out in the cold. Do you think that that's the trajectory we're on right now?
Well, I'll say that small political turbulences, even if they can be resolved even within a year or 2 years, they will have long-lasting ramifications. Like I said before, the United States has already deindustrialized, and now with these energy cuts, Europe is also heading towards that direction. There's going to be mass political discontent. You know, when people's heating is cut off in their homes, when factories are shut down due to energy costs, no one's going to be blaming Russia or Saudi Arabia or China. They're all going to be blaming their own governments. And you know, we see the rise of nationalist leadership in various Western states for that exact reason.
Daniel, as our final question to you, come midterms, November 4th or 10th, I forget, and let's say the Republicans take over, do you think Saudi Arabia will change its tune?
No, I think that's a good question. I first of all, the Saudis already promised to increase production next month after cutting back this month, number one. Number two, the Saudis, I think, probably lean more in favor of the Republicans at this point, and the Saudis would be very happy to see Donald Trump back in the White House. So I think that that they are maybe hoping that'll come to pass, and I think that the Republicans, okay, if they take control of Congress, will not move to further disturb U.S.-Saudi relations.
Thank you. We're fresh out of time. Thank you so much. Our guests, both from New York, Hassan Ali, scientist, writer, and political analyst, a pleasure. Daniel Lazar, thank you so much, journalist and author, again, both from New York. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tavlay and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You're listening to the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Al-Musavi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatihi wa barakatuh, and welcome to the program Bridge. We are looking at supplication number 8 of Al-Sahif al-Sajjadiyya for Al-Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salamullah. We go to the part where the Imam says, O Allah, I seek refuge in you from wa mukhalafatul huda, rejecting guidance. We spoke about guidance and we said there are different levels of guidance in the Quran. First is the general guidance, which every human being, every animal, every object out there get some sort of guidance from Allah, which we all share. Ar-Rahman, Ar-Rahim. He is merciful to all his creatures, obviously most merciful to the believers. And then we said we have another type, which is guidance, which Allah sends messengers and preachers to guide me towards the truth. Now, this is what we got up to. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in the Quran, he says, وَهَدَيْنَاهُ النَّجْدَيْنِ. And also he says, وَمَا كُنَّا مُعَذِّبِينَ حَتَّى نَبْعَثُ رَسُولًا, that when it comes to him, we have shown him the two paths, the good and the bad. And we will not have punished him, and we will not punish anyone until we show them both paths. And this is by far the greatest gift and blessing Allah could give anyone, to show you the path. No human being on Day of Judgment can come to Allah and argue the fact that he did not know or no one told me. That's not going to work. All right? If you haven't not learned, the hadith says, Allah will say, then why have you not learned? Right? And so this is the guidance of the messengers of and prophets. Then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, كُلَّمَا أُلْقِيَ فِيهَا فَوْجٌ. Every time Allah throws a group of people in hellfire, they will say something. What do they say? Let us take a break and find out.
A path to salvation. A way to connect the two worlds.
A bridge between Allah and His creation.
A bridge that is meant to take us to Allah, to take us to His proximity. A bridge that is in the form of dua and supplication.
In this program, we offer commentary on the du'as of As-Sahifatu Sajjadiyyah of Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam.
The famous book of litanies, the Psalms of Islam.
Bridge.
Rabbana.